This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing the oral history interview with Lieutenant Colonel John Ewell. Today's date is the 14th of October, 2004. I am in the interview room in the Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech, and Colonel Ewell is in Fort Worth, Texas, joining me by telephone. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
John, I want to ask you just a little bit, carrying on from what we talked about day before yesterday. I'm interested in how you actually arranged to go from being a navigator to getting into flight training as a pilot.
Well, the procedure was you could apply, and I don't know if there was any restriction as to if I had to wait for a certain period of time. The only thing I remember that it was contingent on to apply for pilot training was taking the Class 1 physical. This physical was, as I recall, was a little more strenuous than the normal annual physical.
Sure.
For flying status.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I recall it. I may or may not be correct on that, but that's my recollection. So, again, as I recall, all I did was take that Class 1 physical, submit my application,
mm-hmm.
and then I think the next thing I found out was, well, there's about a two-year wait for navigators applying for pilot training to get a slot. So, because I know I had to take at least one and maybe two physicals to keep my application current. Every year, I'd have to take that Class 1 physical again.
And what, if you remember, did the Class 1 physical have as components that
yeah.
the earliers did not? The
yeah,
early
that
ones
I
not?
That I don't recall. The
okay.
only thing that I recall about that physical that I was quite concerned about was the eye requirement.
Sure.
And it was even more of a concern at the particular base I was at, i.e. McClellan Air Force Base in Sacramento,
mm-hmm.
because this friend of mine, I told you about J.T. Bailey, the guy that he and I were the two in the cadet class at Harlingen that took the two ferry command assignments out, that we got the one-time good deal assignment. But we both applied for pilot training at the same time.
Okay.
And J.T., his eyes were fine, except that when they dilated them, one eye was 20/30, the other one was 20/20, but they would not give him a waiver for that. And so I remember having a lot of anxiety and concern each year when I would retake that physical that I was still going to be able to pass it. And as a result of the anxiety and concern, I never had a problem with the eye exam, but I did with elevated blood pressure. And so I always had to retake my blood pressure, which was okay. But that's essentially the way it worked. And when you then the next thing in the process was, okay, I found out that I had a class date, and then just waited for that that class date to come up. And that's the way I got in pilot training.
Did you have to take any medication to regulate blood pressure at this
no.
point?
No.
Okay. Would that have been a complete bar?
I think so.
Really?
I really don't know, but I would assume that it would have been.
Okay.
And the reason I say that,
mm-hmm.
Laura,
mm-hmm.
is at that time, and you probably get the drift here, 2 to 3 year wait for navigators applying for pilot training. I mean, the Air Force was in the catbird seat. I mean, they could accept or deny you for any little nitpicking reason because
sure.
obviously they had more applicants than they had slots. So.
And as you say too, the anxiety of worrying about the exam would tend to elevate one's blood pressure at the time it was being taken.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, we're, what, a minute into this conversation,
mm-hmm.
and it's time for another war story. A guy by the name of Gail Golick, who
uh-huh.
turned out to be a good friend of mine,
uh-huh.
but in pilot training with me. And now keep in mind the story I've just told you about the anxiety about passing this test every year,
right.
my buddy JT not passing it because of one eye being 20/30.
Right.
Going out to fly one day in pilot training, and it just so happens that Gale's climbing into his airplane to go fly, and I just happen to be walking by when he's getting strapped in, and I see him pull out this pair of glasses that look like the bottom of Coke bottles.
Uh-oh.
And puts them on. So that evening in the bar, I said, Gale, let's talk. And so he had this, when I hit him with what I had observed, he got this real sheepish look.
Right.
And I said, how in the hell did you ever get into pilot training? And he told me, he said, well, he said, it cost me a lot of bar money because I had to buy this flight surgeon at the, whatever base he was stationed at.
Right.
He said, I bought that guy a ton of drinks, and we became real good buddies, and he gave me a waiver. Moral of the story, right place, right time, right flight surgeon.
That's right.
He was able to get in where he could barely see without his glasses, and my buddy, whose eyes were, for all intents and purposes, fine, mm-hmm. wasn't able to get in because we just happened to have a flight surgeon who, I don't know if he hated pilots or what the deal was, but he just was not going to give a waiver for anything, so... That's my war story on that.
Wow, that's calling it pretty tight.
Yeah, and that, boy, it just shows you how right place, right time.
Yeah. Where did the pilot training actually take place?
Okay, for me, the terminology used then was primary and basic.
Okay.
Which I never, well, primary I understood. Basic always kind of blew my mind. How in the heck did they come up with basic when it was the final 6 months of pilot training? But... The first 6 months for me, the base I went to was Bainbridge, Georgia, about 30 or 40 miles north and a little bit west of Tallahassee, Florida.
Mm-hmm. And how you were there for 6 months?
Correct.
How large was the class?
Oh, man, I don't know. In our class, I would guess maybe, let's see, probably 60 or 70.
And were you actually doing flying exercises as well as classwork in the,
yeah,
in the classroom?
War story number two for the 14th of October.
Okay.
Having gone through NAV school and now being in pilot training, and my pilot buddies don't like to hear me say this, but pilot training was a walk in the park compared to NAV school as far as academics goes. I mean, academics and pilot training was a joke. All you learned was aircraft systems, which wasn't that difficult. And really, the thing in pilot training was hand-eye coordination. How can you fly the airplane? So pilot training for me was just really fun. I really enjoyed it. But fortunately, I didn't have any trouble flying the airplane. So to me, pilot training... just so much easier than NAV school. Of course, the other thing that you have to factor in there is that going through pilot training, I was an officer, and I'd been out in the field for 3.5 years, whereas going through NAV school, I was an aviation cadet, so that I have to factor that in, mm-hmm. too, because that also made it much more difficult going through NAV school. But bottom line, for me, individually, pilot training is just infinitely easier than NAV school was.
John, were you entirely being trained on fixed-wing aircraft?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, the two aircraft I flew at primary at Bainbridge, mm-hmm. Georgia, one was called the T-34.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Beechcraft Bonanza for all intents and purposes, except for two big major modifications. Had tandem seating. And they did away with the detail and had conventional empennage on the airplane. Other than that, it was just a Beechcraft Bonanza. Only got about, probably my guess would be 15, maybe 20 hours in that airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And then went to the what they called the T-28, which there's still T-28s flying in the world today. In fact, they used them as attack airplanes in Vietnam. And this was a single-engine reciprocating engine prop airplane. But I had just happened to be in the very last class to fly in that airplane. And then they transitioned all the pilot training bases to the T-37, which was a little twin-engine jet.
So you were actually training in a prop.
That's right, the last class to go through. In fact, our motto and our class book was Last of the Prop Busters.
you had fun with this, I take it.
Yeah, I enjoyed pilot training. Pilot training... Fortunately for me, pilot training came very easy. I never had a problem really flying the airplane, so I was always doing well. And essentially, in pilot training, as compared to NAV school, in NAV school, probably most of your time was spent in the classroom,
mm-hmm.
academically.
Mm-hmm.
But you did fly. You did actually fly missions. But you could have easily performed your functions sitting in a classroom, as it just happened that you were in an airplane when you were doing it. But you could have been doing it in a classroom. Whereas pilot training, most of your time was spent in the air. And the minority of the time was academic.
Where did you go after Bainbridge?
After Bainbridge to Enid, Oklahoma.
Okay, and was that where primary was?
Yeah.
Okay.
No.
Basic. Primary. I beg your pardon.
Yeah, primary. Yeah. Was Bainbridge, then yeah. Basic was, and I never understood that term,
right.
Basic.
Now I'm confused.
Yeah, well, and I still am, like just now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but anyway, that was a terminology they used at that time. Yeah.
And what happened at Enid that was different from what had gone on at Bainbridge?
Not much, except, well, two main differences. Uh-huh. Now I'm in a jet aircraft.
Okay, which one?
The T-33.
Okay,
And, if you're familiar with that, Laura, that was the trainer version of the F-80.
Okay.
The first jet fighter we had in this country.
Right.
And then they converted it to a trainer. That was one major difference.
Mm-hmm.
The second major difference was at Bainbridge, it was a contract flying school. By that I mean the Air Force contracted out for all the instructors. The only military pilots in the organization of Bainbridge were the Czech pilots.
Now, for somebody who doesn't get that reference, what's a Czech pilot?
Okay, that's the one that rides with you when you, let's take an example, formation
mm-hmm.
flying. Okay, you might have 30 hours of training, flying formation with your instructor. When your instructor thinks that you're ready to get your Czech ride, and that's where a Czech pilot goes up with you
mm-hmm.
and says, yes, this guy meets the criteria, the requirement. We sign him off as being formation qualified in pilot training. That was the big ride. At the end of your training missions with your instructor pilot, when he felt you were ready, then he put you up for your check ride with this military pilot who flew with you to see if you were meeting the standards, whatever they were, for a student pilot flying formation. And the same thing was true with instruments.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing was true with what we called contact flying. That is, you're just looking outside the airplane. You're not really focusing on the instruments or formation.
What was the contractor there who was employing the trainers?
I think you should ask. Because the significance of that didn't hit me until a few years later.
Okay.
It was an organization called Southern Airways. Does that mean anything to you?
Well, I have a feeling that they were contracting for a certain civilian agency.
Well, that's it. And the civilian agency was Southern Airways. Yeah. But does that name Southern Airways ring any bells in your mind?
Well, I'm thinking a contract with the Central Intelligence Agency.
You broke the code.
Okay.
That was it.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that blew my mind later when I found that out. Because I had no idea at the time. And I don't even know if they were affiliated with CIA at that time. This is back in 58, so they may not have been. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know they were in Vietnam.
Yes. Uh-huh.
That's when I found out, when I was over there and saw these weird airplanes flying around, these secret stuff, and somebody mentioned Southern Airways, and I said, Southern Airways? Stand by one. Wait a minute, I'm familiar with that outfit.
Right.
Yeah. So,
who were the instructors that you had? What kinds of flying experience did they have? Did they talk about that?
War story number three. Miles Eldridge, my instructor pilot. And, man, he was old as dirt. I thought he was probably 35 or 40.
Right.
But he looked like 135 to me. And I thought, my God, how's this guy make it out to the airplane, climb in? Little guy, little scrawny guy. And a man of very few words. And primarily the thing I remember hearing him say, and I talked to the other, most of the student pilot ratio was 4 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
One instructor would have 4 students.
Okay.
It varied some. I don't think anybody had more than 4, but some had 3, some had 2, depending upon the makeup of the class, how many instructor pilots were available. But I recall my classmates that were also students of Miles, that we all compared notes, obviously, and we all came to the same conclusion. Miles didn't have a lot to say. But the term I remember is, Yule, you're regressing. That was one of his favorite comments. But to answer your question, I will never forget my first instrument training ride in him, and it was kind of kind of a dollar ride. One of the things that changed there was all your rides up to instrument training were the student were always in the front seat. The instructor was in the back seat because you were learning to fly the airplane. You were taking off. You were landing. So you were up front where you could see better, and the instructor sat in the back. Well, in instrument training, you changed seats. You went in the back, and he was up front. And they had a hood that you had to pull up over the canopy so you couldn't see outside the airplane. You had to just fly on the instruments.
Okay, wow.
So at any rate, he's just the first ride is what we used to call a dollar ride. You're just along. He's going to demonstrate a few things. He's going to tell you how the instrument training portion of pilot training is going to be. So he's flying along there, and he says, okay, I'm going to demonstrate a constant rate of climb. And in a constant rate of climb, what we want to do is climb at a certain feet per minute number, and we want to maintain the same airspeed and maintain the same heading. And so he's demonstrating it. And I can see him because he's in the front seat now, and his head's all over the place. He's looking around for other aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at those gauges, and they're all frozen. I mean, nothing is off. Everything
Ouch.
Is nailed.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, how in the hell is he doing that? That those guys were just that good.
Yeah.
I think most
no
of
kidding.
Them had 100 million hours or something. I mean, they were so experienced. But as far as war stories, no, because of the student. I think the thing was a student-instructor relationship,
mm-hmm.
that they didn't fraternize with us. They were the instructors, we were the students, and there wasn't any fraternization going on.
But, for example, he wouldn't say to you, I flew
no.
such and such in
never
Korea
did.
Or anything
never,
like that.
Never did. Now, it could very well be that some of the others did with their students, which I would imagine they probably did, because I do remember vaguely that some of the other students had instructors that were a little more outgoing and gregarious than Miles was.
Mm-hmm.
So probably, I wouldn't be surprised, they probably had a beer or two and probably did talk about some of their prior experience, but Miles never did. He was a commensurate professional.
Mm-hmm.
No laughing, giggling, being buddy-buddy, none of that with Miles.
Did you ever come across him again, John?
Never did, and I have no clue as to what happened with Miles.
What about the other guys that were in your group with him,
mm-hmm.
the other trainees, the other
right.
pilot trainees?
At our table?
Yeah. Is that what it was called?
Yeah. In fact, that's what it was. It was a big room with a series of like card tables in the room,
mm-hmm.
and that's where you sat with your instructor, and that's where you briefed before you went out to fly, that's where you debriefed when you came in, and you'll like the next war story. here we are.
Okay.
They had a procedure, a little thing that they would do on Friday afternoons as we were buttoning up for the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
It was a formal ceremony, and it was the presentation of the Wedge of the Week Award. Somebody went over to the woodworking shop and took a piece of wood,
mm-hmm.
and made a wedge out of it, just like a normal wedge,
mm-hmm.
lacquered it up, put an eyelet in the top, attached to a string, and this string would be attached to the ceiling in this big room, and this wedge would be placed over the seat, the chair of the student who had won the Wedge of the Week Award.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I remember about the presentation, of course, his instructor would tell the whole assembled group why his student was the recipient of this prestigious award for the week.
Yes.
And it stayed over that student's desk for the week until next Friday afternoon when it was reassigned, that you didn't repeat. You did not want to be a three-time or four-time winner of this award. And the way the presentation went was, and this week, Lieutenant Ewell is the recipient of the Wedge of the Week Award, and this award, to remind you, is this to explain a wedge is the simplest tool known to man. And so this year, or this week, Lieutenant Ewell has received this award for trying to land gear up or whatever the story might be. So that was a Friday afternoon occasion that we had for the Wedge of the Week Award.
Now, John, did you take that prestigious honor?
I never did.
You never did.
No. And in fact, I don't think anybody at our table did. But it was really interesting. The other, Chuck Pugh, and Bill Heckendorf. That's right. The four of us were all pretty good students, and none of the four at our table really had much problem. Whereas there were a lot of guys washing out. Again, the attrition rate in pilot training comes pretty heavily at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And there were quite a few guys leaving, but it just so happened. And also, the other thing to mention here.
Sure.
In my class, and again, I don't know, I'd say 50 or 60 maybe, but I do know that approximately half of our class were navigators. And that had just started a few months before that, where there was such a heavy influx of navigators going through pilot training.
As opposed to
people out of ROTC.
Yeah, young men coming out of college.
Right. Uh-huh. ROTC grads, and they still had cadets at that time, I think. Although, having said that, I'm not really sure if the cadet program had not already been phased out by 58. It might have been, because I know we didn't have any cadets at our base. I know half of our class were ROTC. So I think maybe the aviation cadet program had already been phased out of the Air Force by that time.
Okay.
Which was only, 3 years after I had graduated from NAV school. So somewhere in that 3-year period, they phased out aviation cadets. So half the class were navigators, half the class were ROTC guys coming right out of school.
It's very interesting because you're sort of riding the cusp here between, a whole series of institutional and technical changes that were affecting the whole structure of the Air Force, and you're kind of riding right along with those changes.
Yeah.
Very interesting period.
Yeah, you're right. That is interesting that I just happened to be in that time, that particular time. And it was interesting. We had a huge advantage initially because we'd been out in the field. We'd been flying.
Yes.
And a lot of us had been flying in an aircraft that kind of prepared us for the. For example, when I got the basic at Enid in the jet, I'd been ferrying jet aircraft, so I was used to the helmet, the mask, and all that stuff. Whereas the ROTC guys, they had never had a helmet on before; they'd never worn an oxygen mask, and it was just having that familiarity with the Air Force and being out operational.
Yes.
Gave us a big advantage initially, but within a couple of weeks, that advantage was gone. Then it depended upon what your skill level was, and there was no advantage after. Once they got into the routine, then the advantage was gone.
Right, but still, some of those things in the first days.
Oh, first days,
probably,
big advantage
yeah.
for we navigators. Yeah.
I want to ask you about the aircraft themselves. How much were you learning about weapon systems that were going to be introduced or that were already deployed on the aircraft that you were flying?
In pilot training?
Mm-hmm.
Zero.
No kidding.
Yeah.
So this was all about handling the aircraft?
It's all about flying an airplane.
Okay.
Nothing tactical. Nothing that has to do with, if you're going to fighters, with fighter tactics. If you're going to bombers, with bomb runs. If you're going to transports, hauling cargo, nothing specialized. It's strictly fly the airplane.
Now, all of that would come later.
That's correct.
Okay.
Then you went to what they called advanced training. For example, out of pilot training, I went to F-86s, which was the Air Defense Command.
Yeah.
And that's where I received specialized training in making intercepts on other aircraft and how to shoot them down. That type of advanced schooling came after pilot training.
And that was at Perrin?
Correct.
Okay. I want to ask you about that, but first, I want to just get a sense of your own thinking about your flying skills during this period of pilot training. Mm-hmm. Did you think that you were an intuitive flyer, that you could basically just do it by feel? You knew once you got the system of the aircraft in hand that you could handle it on your own?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I did. And mm-hmm. But I didn't go in with that. I didn't go in that optimistic. I didn't go in thinking I was the world's greatest pilot. Mm-hmm. But after about 2 or 3 weeks in pilot training, then I started thinking I may be the world's greatest pilot because it came so easy to me. And I was, mm-hmm. of course, talking to my friends daily, and it was apparent a lot of them were really struggling. And I just thought, wow, am I ever lucky? Because it, to me, it was just so easy. I just didn't have a problem. And this, I know, really helped me the rest of the way through pilot training, because I'm sure that my confidence is just like in sports.
Yeah.
If you're confident, you're going to play better. You're going to be a better player. But how do I want to word it? The chicken and the egg. If you're confident, you play well. But then if you start going off your game and then you lose confidence, now you got to get back into that cycle. And it's a vicious cycle, and you see it with athletes all the time.
Right.
They start losing that confidence, and then there goes the game, and now how do you get it back?
And they got to dig out from both of those.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. So it's a vicious cycle you get into. And but fortunately, I never lost confidence as I went through pilot training, and I'm sure that had a lot to do with my ending up really very near the top of the class at graduation.
Now, did that have something to do with your next assignment? And
it had everything to do with it.
I figured.
Yeah, the assignments worked the same way as they did out in nav school. Very same way.
Okay.
Your class standing, you got that list, and mm-hmm. then they just put all the assignments up and said, okay, pick your assignment. That worked the same way. And that changed, too, a number of times. But it just so happened, again, your comment about when I came along and when all this transition was taking place,
mm-hmm.
fortunately for me, it was still the student got to choose, depending upon his class standing. That's the way it was when I went through, which was very fortunate. My son, when he went through pilot training, of course, this was years and years later, but then the instructors had much more input as to where that student was going to go.
About when did he go through?
He went through in 84. I think it was 84 when he graduated.
Okay.
From pilot training.
Okay. Tell me how you decided to choose the advanced training option that you went for.
Well, back to the Top Gun syndrome. I mean, there were probably, let's assume there were 50 people in my class.
Right.
There might have been 3 or 4 that wanted airplanes other than fighters. Everybody wanted to be a fighter pilot. So that's what everybody wanted, but there weren't that many fighter pilot assignments.
How many were there?
I don't recall the numbers, but I know that there were very few ADC assignments. The F-86s in ADC and Air Defense Command.
Mm-hmm.
There were quite a few day fighter assignments in TAC. Now, this takes a little explaining, and
okay.
it's one of my poor John stories. Poor John. How unfortunate. Everybody, normally, all things being equal and no external forces working, everyone would want the day fighters because there you're doing air-to-air, you're doing this kind of stuff. ADC, the assignment I took in Air Defense Command, the way you intercepted aircraft, you had your head down in a radar scope in your airplane. You were locking onto this airplane on your radar set. You weren't looking outside the airplane. And that's not the type of flying that fighter pilots like to do. They like to be looking out the airplane and seeing another airplane and getting into furball fights with that other airplane. So, but the reason I chose the F-86 and ADC, and so did the other 3 or 4, there were only like 3 or 4 86s in ADC that were available
mm-hmm.
was that this is 1959 now when I'm graduating.
Right.
And SAC is at their apex. I mean, they are the 600-pound gorilla in the Air Force.
Right.
What Kurt LeMay wants, Kurt LeMay gets.
Okay.
And as you might imagine, the people coming out of pilot training, the bottom feeders were going to SAC. Nobody wanted to go to bombers and SAC. So Kurt and his boys were aware of this, and they said, where are the top graduates going? And where they were going were to day fighters, to TAC. And so SAC then, as soon as they completed this advanced training, which you were asking me about before,
sure, sure.
which lasted about 6 months,
mm-hmm.
when they finished their advanced training, SAC stepped in and gobbled them all up.
So they were SAC was overriding.
SAC
the
was
day
overriding
fighters.
Everything in the Air Force.
And
whatever
grabbing.
SAC wanted, they got. TAC was furious. They spent 6 months and all this time and money training this guy to be a fighter pilot, and here comes SAC in and scarfs them up and takes them off the SAC. And makes them bitter. I mean, the guys were the pilots are bent out of shape because they're in SAC. TAC's been out of shape because SAC has stolen the guys they're training to be fighter pilots.
What would those trained fighter pilots, the day fighters, actually be flying when they were scarfed up by SAC?
B-47. They went to
Ouch.
B-47, so now that means immediately they go to another six-month school to get the specifics on the B-47 and the bombing mission. So at any rate, Laura, where I happen to come along on this timeline is when this is taking place. So my instructor told me, he said, John, he said, you don't want to go to day fighters, and you'll have 6 months, and then you're going to be in SAC. Go to ADC, even though it is Air Defense Command, at least you'll stay in fighters. Sound like a good idea to me. So myself and these other three or four guys, that's exactly what we did. Well, guess what? As we are finishing up pilot training and as I am going off to my 86 assignment, by this time the trend has changed in that other people have learned what's happening when they go to day fighters.
Yep.
So now the bottom people in the class are going to day fighters and the top people are going other places. And so once again, SAC says, well, where in the hell are they going now?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, it looks like most of them are going to ADC so they can stay in fighters. Okay, we'll go get them there. So if I, and I never did, Laura, I never ran into one of my pilot training classmates who regrettably, reluctantly had to go to day fighters, and they stayed in fighters, and myself and the others that went to ADC all got caught up by SAC. So that's my feel sorry for John story.
Gosh darn it, you had to go and fly B-52s.
That's right, and and that's how it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, if I would have ever run into one of those classmates of mine who was way below me in the class standing and was still flying fighters when I was in buff, I would have killed the guy.
Wow.
But at any rate, that's the sad story on how that all transpired.
Well, so after finishing at Perrin,
mm-hmm.
you were thinking, great, I'm going to be in the F series. I'm going to be
that's right.
flying fighters.
Yeah.
And when did you find out that, in fact,
the class ahead of us.
Oh, really?
The class graduating ahead of us, like two classes ahead of us, they were going to fighter assignments.
Right.
But the class immediately ahead of us, almost all of them went to SAC. And that's when we all just kind of died on the vine in my class. And
just,
almost all of us went to SAC.
Just took the wind right out.
Oh, yeah. In fact, okay, next war story.
Yep.
Walter Dawes, my first aircraft commander in B-52s. And I remember the first ride with him. And he, being a very observant type person, picked up on the fact that I seemed to have an attitude problem. He knew the history. He knew the story. And so he and I did not get off to a very good start. He was pointing out to me how much more complicated this stupid buff was and how more demanding that was to be a co-pilot in a buff rather than a pilot in a fighter. And so we had totally different views of the world as to which was the more demanding and which required the more skill. And that went on and on for time. Now, I have to give old, and by the way, today we are best friends and have been ever since we flew together.
Mm-hmm.
We still stay in touch, and he's just a great guy. But, and I have to give him credit for a good move on his part. Shortly after I had crewed up with him, and we were on a mission, a training mission, and so something came up about fighters versus bombers on interphone. And he said, all right, Yuma. And he said, here's the deal. You can have number 8 engine for the next 30 minutes. Do whatever you want to do with number 8 engine. Play like you're a fighter pilot. Well, the rest of the crew thought that was kind of interesting. So, and I had to give him credit. That was kind of a good line. He was going to give me that one engine to play with.
Yeah, that was sweet of him.
Yeah.
Now, you said that he called you Yuma.
Yeah.
Can you tell me how that nickname came about?
And speaking of nicknames, that proved to be helpful throughout my career, and even today it's helpful. Because if someone from my long-lost past calls and they're starting to chat and they haven't ID'd themselves yet,
mm-hmm.
it's how they address me gives me a real big clue as to where they knew me.
Oh, okay.
If they call me Boz, because that was my nickname in aviation cadets when I went through
sure.
cadet training,
mm-hmm.
because it just so happened that the guys that I really got tight with, one was from Trenton, New Jersey, the other one was from Boston, Massachusetts, and the other one was from Syracuse, New York. And I guess the other guy was from Fullerton, California. Cities.
Yeah.
And here I am from Boswell, Indiana with these guys.
Yeah.
They just loved it. They were.
They couldn't resist.
They could not.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my name, Boswell. Hey, Boswell. And it was shortened to Boz.
Okay.
The Boz. So when anyone from my distant past would call and say, hey, Boz, cadets.
Right.
Somebody I knew in cadets.
Right.
Okay. So then I didn't have a nickname until I got into SAC. And the guy that gave me that Yuma nickname was Walt Dawes, my aircraft commander. And when I was introduced to him for the first time, he said, John Yule, Johnny Yuma. That was when this Nick Adams, Johnny Yuma was a big TV series thing.
Okay.
And so that's the way he said it. He just said, John Yule, Johnny Yuma. And so he started calling me Yuma. 6 years later, when I left the B-52 and went to the best airplane in the world, the B-58, to tell you how nicknames can get to be too permanent, too identify you too strongly.
Right.
I'm an instructor now in the B-52 by this time, and we've got a new pilot just come into the organization, and he's going for an orientation ride with me. And we're in the squadron building mission planning. I happen to overhear a conversation in the hallway. And it's this pilot just come in the organization, and he's looking for me. And I hear him ask this new co-pilot that's just been in the wing for just maybe a couple months. And I can hear him saying, well, do you know where Captain Yule's at? I'm supposed to fly with him tomorrow. And I hear this lieutenant say, Captain Yule? He said, I don't know if Captain Yule. He said, are you sure this is bombers? And he said, yeah. And I'm listening to this, so I go out in the hallway, and whoever this kid was, I said, what the hell are you doing telling this guy you don't know who I am? And he said, Yuma. I thought, uh-oh, this nickname is too embedded when the guy doesn't even know what my real name is.
Right.
The only thing he knows is the nickname.
Right. That is a little worrying.
Yeah. So, but at any rate, anyone that knew me for that six-year period, that's the way they're going to address me, is Yuma.
Now, the six-year period we're talking about is 1960 to 66.
Correct.
And your assignment was in Altus, Oklahoma.
Correct. That is correct.
Okay. You started off doing what? You said you ended up instructing, actually, in
B-52s. Yeah. And I went the normal route that everybody goes.
Okay.
Co-pilot, the pilot, which is aircraft commander, and then from there to instructor pilot. So that's just a normal progression. If you're in an organization long enough, that's the way you'll go.
Which of those did you like best? I can guess which one you liked least, but
yeah, probably the instructor pilot.
Why?
Getting to fly with more people, because normally even as a co-pilot or pilot, most of your flying was with your crew. You very seldom flew with other people in the wing.
Okay.
And so as an instructor pilot, you got to fly with more people.
So you would have, as co-pilot and as pilot, you would have a set crew that you
correct.
Worked with?
That is correct.
Okay. And tell me about the routine during those years. Were you essentially trying to keep hours of flight, or were you actually flying missions as well?
A typical year during those 6 years, the earlier years when I was a co-pilot, and it was really essentially the same for the whole 6 years I was there. But typically the way it worked was, I think it averaged probably 2 out of the 4 weeks, half the time,
mm-hmm.
you were on alert. And are you familiar with alert?
Well, I am, but other listeners might not be, so could you explain what that means?
Okay, alert.
Uh-huh.
This means that you go into this heavily reinforced building that usually was half underground and half above ground, and it was out away from the main base at the end of a runway.
Okay.
And surrounding this building were, at Altus, where I was stationed, and this was typical of most SAC bases, I think we had usually 7 or 8 B-52 aircraft on alert. And by aircraft on alert, I mean they were fully loaded with nuclear weapons and fuel, ready to go instantly to strike targets in Russia. And also sitting out there on the ramp around that building were an equal number of tankers, because you would be mated up with a tanker and you would air refuel on the way to your target. And you would spend a week at a time. Now, this varied. Some bases had an alert schedule where you'd be on alert 3 days and then off 4.
Mm-hmm.
But our schedule all the time I was at Altus was, ours was a week. You were on a week. And so you spent a lot of time on alert with your crew and with 7 other bomber crews and 7 other tanker crews.
And you were all segregated down in this special building?
Yeah, you weren't really segregated. Well, I'm trying to remember how that worked. I think as far as rooms went, I think the pilot and the co-pilot had a room, and then the nav and radar went. That's right. They were 2-man rooms. That was it. 2-man rooms, and you'd have the nav and radar in a room, and then the EW and the gunner were in a room by themselves. And really, the tanker people and the bomber people were kind of mixed in.
Mm-hmm.
And the way alert worked is you're in that building. And when this klaxon went off, when this horn blew, everybody ran to their assigned aircraft, got in the aircraft, started engines, and turned on the radio to see if it was a practice mission or if it was a real thing. And this is what you did most of the time for those 6 years. Now, when you weren't on alert, you were flying, or mission planning to fly, or going to ground training, getting ground training on any number of subjects,
okay.
or mission planning to fly training missions. Normal training mission was usually about 8 hours. Took a day to mission plan it and a day to fly it. So that was a typical life for a crew member in B-52s. In the 60s. Now, there was one other exception. About every, I would say about every 9 months maybe, your wing, your base, would get their turn at flying airborne alert. This was something that went on continuously.
Mm-hmm.
There were X number of B-52s in the air all the time, and the philosophy behind this was, if all the bases were struck by Russian missiles, at least we would have some aircraft airborne with weapons aboard that we could strike the targets so they wouldn't catch us on the ground. So
now these B-52s that were flying the airborne alert were fully armed with nuclear weapons.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And those were 24-hour missions. And like I said, I think it was about when your wing picked that up, you'd fly two a day because you would take off together. And I think it lasted for about 45 days to 60 days, I think, that you were doing that.
Okay. And you would fly a 24-hour
mission.
And how many times would you refuel in the course of that?
Usually just once. But it was, we were taking on a lot of fuel. We'd have one refueling, and it came, as you might imagine, not quite in the middle, a little closer to the front end, probably maybe 8 or 9 hours after you took off. And we were getting pretty low on fuel at the time we'd have that refueling. And we were taking on, the way I remember it was, if you hooked up, had no disconnects, it would take 28 minutes to transfer the fuel, and you were transferring about 200 and some thousand pounds of fuel.
Wow.
So, it was only one AR normally.
One AR?
Air refueling, I'm sorry.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And were the tankers also essentially flying 24-hour missions too?
No.
Okay, they had a completely different pattern.
Yeah, they would just launch like the route that we flew most, although not always, but the mm-hmm. one that I flew the most was a Chrome Dome route, that was the name for it, and it went out over Spain, and we used to refuel over Spain. And the tankers would come up from a base we had in Spain,
mm-hmm.
and they would take off, climb to altitude, hook up with us, offload their fuel, and then land immediately. So their mission probably was less than an hour. But they went from a full load of fuel to no fuel in
wow.
that hour.
Wow.
Because they were offloading everything they had on board almost.
Right. What year was the accident over Spain where some of the, I think it was during a refueling, wasn't it?
Yeah, it definitely was. It was one of these missions. Yep, you're right. And when would that have been? Maybe 64, 65, I don't know,
somewhere along there.
Yeah.
But you were flying essentially the same route that...
Exactly the same route, the same mission.
That the Palomares?
Right, that was it, uh-huh, yeah.
Did you have any difficulty with the 24-hour schedule there? How'd you guys handle that?
The way it normally worked, or anyway, the way I worked it with my crew was I wanted to be as alert as I possibly could be for the critical areas of flight. And the critical areas of flight on an airborne alert were obviously takeoff, climb out, air refueling, and landing. So I would try to get a little rest before the tanker, and I would try to get some, the other place I'd try to get some rest is before we got back to base to land. And they had a little area behind the pilot and co-pilot seats that you could stretch out on a sleeping bag and try to get a little sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was that, and the way you did it was the pilot would get out, go back, and take a nap. The co-pilot would be flying the airplane, and then when you were up there, the co-pilot would go back and take a nap. So you just switched
right.
off in the nav, and the radar did the same thing.
Okay. How much of how much of the guidance systems for the aircraft were actually automated at this point? Were you doing all the flying?
No, we had autopilot. In fact, but occasionally. If you were that unfortunate, I think it happened to us a couple of times, where you would have an autopilot malfunction,
mm-hmm.
and you'd have to hand fly that airplane for 24 hours.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
Oh, that was brutal. That was brutal when that would happen. But fortunately, it didn't happen that often.
When did autopilot actually come in, John?
I have no idea.
But it was there when you were there.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And normally it worked fine. So most of the mission was on autopilot.
Were there any memorable times when it didn't, when autopilot failed or some part of the mechanism was?
No, I don't remember, but I've got, as you might imagine, I've got a few war stories that tie into airborne alert.
I bet you do. I was going to ask about a couple of national crises that might
how about
have provoked
the Cuban?
Some.
How about the Cuban crisis? Okay.
So this would be October 62.
Yeah, and I'm still a co-pilot now.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Here's the deal. There's a party at the Yacht Club, and everybody's drunk and disorderly, and the wing commander calls for attention and says, all right, all you drunken idiots, go home, get in bed, get some crew rest. Things are happening. Be ready to go. And remember how I told you the this alert, airborne alert cycle between the different bases and
yes.
wings?
Yes.
Okay. Now, with the Cuban crisis, every base is going to be flying airborne alert.
Every SAC base?
Every SAC base is going to be putting up airplanes on airborne alert.
Wow.
And so we start getting the word on what's coming up that we're going to be flying airborne alert, and we know we're nowhere close to our cycle. We also know what's going on in Cuba. So there isn't any mystery as to why this increased alert.
Now, did you know about this because of briefings or because of the newspaper? Or
newspaper, okay. Just read, you know, Dave, because remember how, well, you may not, but it was, I mean, it was scary. In fact, one of my all-time favorite war stories is coming up here. The one I tell most is
okay.
coming up shortly.
Okay, good.
But I'll try to keep it sequential here. The, any rate, we take off, and now I'm a co-pilot. Okay, so we're taking off at, we're in one of the first two airplanes to launch from our base on this increased readiness mission.
Mm-hmm.
And we're flying that normal Chrome Dome route out over Spain. And the news is ominous. This is just about the time that the quarantine's going into effect. And everybody is sky high. I mean, everybody is peaked and tweaked.
Mm-hmm.
And emotions are raw. And I can remember when we took off, and I'm wondering if I'll ever see Rose and the kids again, because we really did believe the balloon was going up. I really thought there was a good chance that Altus would not exist when that mission was over. That was, trying to set stage for the emotions that
yes,
everybody's feeling
yes,
at this time.
Absolutely.
And at any rate, it just so happens that whenever we took off, it's about the war story is that it was about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and the way this worked for, you would get a message over your radio that was what we called the go code, and this is how you executed. This is what gave you the authority to strike your target, and everybody was listening intently for this message to come across the radio. Well, it's 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. My pilot is back asleep because he's trying to get some rest before we hit the tanker.
Okay.
And I'm up there by myself and in formation with this other B-52. And all at once, and it's a very dark night, and all at once, off in front of me, the sky starts lighting up like somebody turned a light on. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, they just hit Morón, our tanker base in Spain. And I'm thinking, that's a nuke. They have just set off a nuke. They have hit our tanker bases in Spain. And I called the other airplane, and I said, hey, do you see what I see? And the guy said, yes, I do. And I said, have you heard any message? Have you heard anything on the radio? And he said, I haven't heard a word. About that time, this light that was getting brighter and brighter breaks through the undercast we had, and what it was a full moon. And I tell you, Laura, to this day, I don't think I have ever been as frightened as I was for those few seconds before that moon broke through that undercast. I think I was more frightened then than I was with anything that happened in getting shot down and being a POW. I just knew that World War III had begun. So, to continue, as it turned out, we had some aircraft problems. We lost an engine right after refueling. So, SAC tells us to land at Morón, or at the Torreón, not Torreón, what is the name of that base? Anyway, Nuassur. In North Africa.
Mm-hmm.
We had a base there. We land. We go in the command post. And the guy in the command post tells me, he said, okay, you tell us how much fuel we can put on your airplane so that you can make a 7-engine takeoff and go strike your target. And so this was kind of the atmosphere, the situation that existed during this this crisis time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's my war story on that.
Wow. Well, that's a heck of a story. John, what was the what was the target for your particular mission?
I don't know now. With the targets that we had changed,
yes.
Every time you went on alert,
yes.
You would have different set of targets. In fact, you went on alert about 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning. You changed over the box. The box is what had the go code in it,
okay.
And all the maps of the target area and everything. And this was under lock, a combination lock that the pilot and the bomb aimer both had locks on this box.
Okay.
And so you had to switch that box over from the crew that was going off alert. You're coming on alert, accepting the airplane, accepting the box. Then in the afternoon, you target studied whatever your set of targets were,
mm-hmm.
for that particular sortie. And so all I know is they were targets in Russia, probably missile sites or airfields or something like that. But now that I think about a couple other airborne alert stories,
yes.
before I forget them.
Okay, good.
And this is further down the road now. And, what makes me think of it is your commenting on the accident over Spain when the nukes went in the water.
Right.
And all the political implications of that.
Yes.
Okay, now by this time I'm an aircraft commander. I'm a pilot. And I'm flying a different airborne alert route. This is up over Canada in the Northwest Territory.
Mm-hmm.
We had just come off the tanker, full fuel load, and just about to engage the autopilot when the airplane starts shaking violently. And look at the engine instruments. Everything looks normal. Look at the airplane as best you can see it. Everything looks okay. And it's just really vibrating badly. And so I called the gunner who sits in the back of the airplane. I said, "Gunner, do you see anything unusual?" And he looked around and he said, "Well," he said, "on the left wing, it looks like the aileron is just fluttering out there." And I said, that could be the problem. By this time, we've already called SAC Command Post in Omaha,
mm-hmm.
Nebraska. They've got the Boeing people on the phone to talk to us about it.
Okay.
When you get that far away from civilization, we were up way over northern Canada into the Northwest Territory when all this is taking place.
Yeah, pretty remote.
Yeah, and you're out of what we call UHF range, the radios you normally use. The UHF radios had a range of about 150, 200 miles.
Okay.
In stateside, no problem. You're always within range. But when you get way out there, you go to what we call an HF radio, high frequency.
Okay.
And that radio works around the world. But this particular HF radio we had was overheating, and it would automatically shut itself down. And there was about a 3-minute cooling down cycle before you could turn it on again.
Oh, boy.
This plays into this story.
Yeah.
Okay, so Boeing tells me that Boeing tech rep says, okay, try this. So they were having me try different things, airspeed, configuration, put some flaps down, put some spoiler up, whatever, to try to see if we could streamline this aileron. And on more than one occasion, right after they had given me instructions to try this, try that, the HF radio would go off. Then when the cooling period had passed and we could turn it on again, as soon as we'd get that radio on, you'd hear every person in the world trying to get us to answer them. And this happened 2 or 3 different times. Well, long story short, finally they came up with a configuration that worked, but it was a configuration that had us totally dirty. By that I mean gear down, full flaps, air brakes at position 4 or something. Anyway, all kinds of trash hanging out of the airplane, the gear, the flaps, everything.
Right.
Which means that, in a way, it was kind of good because now we have to descend and we have to have a real high power setting because we're real heavy with fuel. And we're heading back south now, back toward the United States. And It just so happened I had a brand new co-pilot who this was his first airborne alert mission. And when we get back, we're landing at the first base we come to when we get back to the States. It was somewhere up in northern Michigan. I don't even remember the base. About 10 o'clock at night on a Saturday night. And we're landing at the max landing weight. Well, everything works fine. And we're taxing in. And Billy Beeble, my co-pilot, he says, "Wow," he said, "look at who's out here to greet us." He said, "There's a three-star general." It just so happened they were having a dining in at this base that night.
Mm-hmm.
And this three-star, the Air Force commander, the numbered Air Force commander, just happened to be the guest speaker that night. So he's out there on the ramp to meet us when we come in. And it was kind of funny because he was down at the hatch when people were getting off the airplane, and I can hear him saying, "Are you the aircraft commander? Are you the aircraft commander?"
Uh-huh.
And I'm thinking, the hell with it. I'm not going off this airplane. I don't want to tell him I'm the aircraft commander, because my fear was, Laura, I thought, with my luck, they're going to say, "There isn't a damn thing wrong with this airplane. What made you think you had a problem?" And that's what I was afraid of.
You were going to get chewed out.
Yeah, yeah, for saying, "What the hell is this vibration problem,
right.
this mythical vibration problem you thought you had?"
Right.
But the three button, when I stepped down and I told him, "Yeah, I'm the airplane driver," he said, "You had a broken push-pull rod on the aileron." They had already gotten the stand up, looked at this aileron, and he said, "Yeah, the push-pull rod broke." He said, "That's why you had the problem." He said, "But God dang you all," he said, "do you know what kind of problems you've caused in the Strategic Air Command here in the last few hours?" And I said, "No, sir." He said, "Well," he said, "you do remember a month ago when we lost those two airplanes over Spain and all the problems we had with that, with those bombs in the water?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Well," he said, "where were you when you were having all your problems?" And I said, "Hmm." He said, "Yeah, hmm." And he said, "and every damn time you lost that radio of yours, we thought we'd lost you." And he said, "that would have been the death knell for airborne alert. We wouldn't have been able to continue airborne alert if we would have had another international incident with the Canadians right after we'd had the international incident with Spain. That probably would have been the end of airborne alert."
Thinking that the political fallout from that would have included
Correct.
Shutting down airspace.
That's it. Well, it would just, and I'm sure he was right, that the international community would have said, "Hey, this is too dangerous.
We're done with this.
This is too dangerous. You
right.
can't be flying these airplanes with nuclear weapons on board over our countries." And he was probably right that probably would have been it.
So, John, you scared the hell out of the SAC.
And John.
I can believe that, actually. How serious, stepping back from that, how serious was the actual mechanical malfunction, the broken, what did you say it was, broken
Oh,
rod?
The push-pull rod on the aileron tab. Yeah, that wasn't really that big a deal once we were able to streamline it. Now, if we wouldn't have been able to streamline it, I think it would have broken the airplane up. The vibration was so bad.
It was that bad?
Yeah, it was really bad. The vibration was bad.
Because
and
the design specs for a B-52 in terms of vibration
oh,
analysis
great.
Must
I mean,
be
it
huge.
Can, yeah, it can take a hell of a lot of punishment. In fact, I remember many times flying low level in a B-52 and looking out at those outboard wing engine pods. And, I mean, they're going up and down, and that wing is flapping around. There's 32 feet of flex at the wingtip of a B-52
32
wing.
32 feet?
32 feet. And you sit in that cockpit, and you see that wing flapping around out there, and you think, I don't care what the engineers say, that wing's coming off. But very few did. I mean, the airplane was so tough.
That's amazing.
But it felt like it was going to, I mean, that vibration, it just felt like it's going to tear this airplane apart. But once we streamlined it, then it was just normal.
Was that the worst case of, you know, that kind of enormous vibration that you ever had in a plane?
I think so. I can't recall anything else similar to that.
Wow.
Yeah, that was probably it.
Now, at this point, did you love the B-52?
I hated it. Hated that damn airplane. I hated it from the minute I saw it. Laura, you've got to watch the History Channel and watch the documentary they did on the B-52.
This is one that you were interviewed for.
Yeah, yeah, because the my first appearance on the program is when they show me walking around the B-52 and looking at that wrinkled skin, and I said, you got to be kidding me. And you want me to fly an airplane with wrinkled skin like this?
When you say wrinkled skin, what exactly are you describing?
One of the unique things about the B-52 is compared to any other airplane that I've ever flown, most normal aircraft, I mean, the skin is tight. It's like you would expect any airplane you've ever seen to be.
Right.
But the B-52, because of its size, the skin actually had wrinkles in it. And with the flexing and the movement of the airplane in flight, that skin was constantly flexing. And on the ground, you'd look at some of those, and those wrinkles in that skin just did not look right. I mean, you thought, what is this deal? And me, my first look at a B-52 coming out of F-86s,
right,
and the guy walking us around the airplane just happened to casually mention how much one of those external fuel tanks weighed, full of fuel. I forget what the weight was, but I do know this. It was more than the F-86 weight.
Than the entire aircraft.
Than the entire F-86 airplane. This airplane, this tip tank full of fuel weighed more. One drop tank on a B-52 full of fuel weighed more than an F-86 airplane. Just to kind of give you a feel for the size of that monster.
What, the skin that you were talking about, what was the material that was made?
It was metal, aluminum.
No kidding.
Yeah, and I'm sure they had problems with skin fatigue, you know, where they probably had to reskin it, but I don't remember that much about it. But there were so many things I hated about that airplane. I mean,
tell me some of the other ones.
Okay, well, it flew like it looked. You know, it looks like a big old 18-wheeler, and that's the way it flew. Now, I'm going to tell you another war story, and I really don't like telling this one because it degrades my world's greatest pilot philosophy or theory. I go to B-52 training, eh? Right out of, I'm a hot fighter pilot coming out of 86s, right?
Right.
Okay, so I'm going through training out at Castle Air Force Base at Merced, California, and obviously the instructor pilot picked up real quickly my attitude problem, because he used to look at me like, okay, Yule, I'm going to get to you somewhere along the line here. I'm going to put you in the seat, and we'll just see. And I should have picked up on that. I had a lot of red flags that kind of just I didn't even notice. That was one of them. But anyway, my pilot, I was, of course, the brand-new co-pilot, and my pilot, Vic Martin, who was upgrading, he had been a co-pilot in B-52s for 3 or 4 years, and he was upgrading to aircraft commander. And Vic was one sharp guy. I mean, this guy was really sharp, except for one thing. He couldn't refuel. He had a terrible time refueling. And I, as the hot fighter pilot, sitting there in the instructor seat, observing these refuelings, and I'm thinking, you know, Vic is such a sharp guy. He's so good at everything else. It's got to be a mental thing with these bomber pilots. You know, they must get so scared when they get close to another airplane that they just can't fly formation.
I got it. Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, you know what this is? This is trail formation. The way I flew trail in fighters was we were doing acro most of the time. We were rat racing. We were all over the sky flying trail and not having any trouble staying in. And I said, and I'm thinking, here's this tanker up here in front of us on autopilot, maintaining a constant heading, constant airspeed, and this guy can't get close enough to refuel. It's got to be mental. Wrong, but that's what I'm thinking.
Right.
And again, I think I was sending strong nonverbals to the instructor pilot, because one day he told me, all right, Yule, he said, if and when we get Vic checked out on refueling, you'll get your chance. Now, that should have really told me something, but it just went right on by me.
Right.
So, the magic day comes. Vic finally gets what he has to do to get signed off as being qualified air refueling. And this instructor pilot almost went berserk getting Vic out of the seat and getting me in there. Man, talk about our huge red flag. I should have known something bad was going to happen.
Yeah, he couldn't wait.
He couldn't wait to get me in that seat. Mm-hmm. And I look back and I think, you were so stupid. What is the deal? But anyway, confidence, lack of confidence. I am so confident, Laura,
right.
So confident that my plan is, Vic, I really like Vic. I am not going to drive right in there and hook up. I'm going to sit back here and act like I'm having some trouble. Then I'll drive in and hook up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm in the seat. The IP says, okay, Yule, you have the airplane. I was almost, I think, 90 degrees bank behind that tanker going from one wing up to the other, all over the place. I can't even get close to that tanker. And Clements, the IP, is just loving every minute of it. He said, oh, that is great. That's a way, fighter pilot. Man, you're doing wonderful. I am so impressed. Excuse me.
That's fine.
And so in the period of about, I'd say, maybe 90 seconds to 2 minutes, I went from supremely confident to saying, there is no way I will ever be able to refuel this stupid airplane if I'm in it forever. I just went from all total confidence to no confidence in about 2 minutes. Later, this, and if you recall, I think we talked the day before yesterday about this neighbor of mine, Harold Bodweed, the black guy.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh.
Harold was the EW on this crew.
Electronic warfare officer.
Mm-hmm. We get back on the ground, and he says, John Harry, he said, my God, he said, what were you doing up there? And I said, this stupid damn airplane. I said, I don't know what the hell the deal is. He said, you scared me to death. I thought we were all going to be killed. And he said, and that stupid instructor pilot just seemed that that's what he was hoping would happen. And I didn't think about the other guys in the airplane, what it must have been like for them. Here's the story. That stupid B-52 airplane, it has what they call spoilers. And instead of flying like a regular airplane, which is with ailerons, and that aileron that I was telling you about was a trim tab where I had the problem.
Yeah.
But primarily the way you turn a B-52 is with spoilers. Spoilers are just what there's a correct term. It spoils the flow of the air over the wing. It's a hydraulically actuated piece of metal that's on the top of the wing, and when you move the yoke, depending upon which way you want to turn, on one wing, this spoiler will come up. And it spoils the lift, and that's what causes the aircraft to turn. Okay, that's a fine dandy, except for one thing. There is a lag. There is a time lapse in there.
How much?
It's probably just less than a second, but to a pilot flying an airplane, it is an eternity, regardless of how fast you're going. Every airplane I flew in my life, except for the stupid B-52, when you moved the stick or the yoke, something happened. When you moved the yoke, the airplane was moving. And in the B-52, now in pitch, it would react instantly, but because of this spoiler system on the wings, it had this delay built in. So what you had to do in a B-52 is learn through experience that if you wanted to just bring the wing up a little bit, you learned through experience that you would make a movement on the yoke, immediately take that movement out, and sit there and wait. And if you waited long enough, the wing would come up a foot or two. But until you learned that, and being used to flying a real airplane, if you move the yoke and the airplane doesn't move, what are you going to do? You're going to move the yoke more.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get into this envelope where you're overcorrecting, constantly overcorrecting. Somebody else once put it the way they said, I can always tell a new pilot in a B-52 because they're so friendly. They're always waving at the tanker or they're waving at the runway. When you have to make small corrections, you're always overcorrecting because nothing's happening when you move that yoke. One of the stories that I like to tell, and it was one of the most popular B-52 stories, was the way the system, it really wasn't a spoiler system, the way it really worked was they built a little squirrel cage under the pilot seat, and it had squirrels in it. And when he moved that yoke, he opened one side of the cage, and the squirrel knew that he was supposed to run out to the end of the wing and tell that wingtip that the pilot wanted it to come up 2 feet or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'd run back and get in his cage, and that's when the wing would move. That's how much time would elapse. So it was the squirrel cage story about how the plane actually moved in the roll action.
Well, that had to be pretty disconcerting, at least at first.
Yeah, and then once you got used to it, in fact, as it turned out, I ended up being one of probably the best refuelers in the B-52 wing that we were in. I went longer without a disconnect than about anybody else once I learned it, but I never did like the airplane. And in fact, it wasn't for this program, the one that I did for the History Channel,
mm-hmm.
but another one that they were doing, and it just so happened that I'd been over to Shreveport at Barksdale Air Force Base for a photo shoot for this thing.
Okay.
And on the way, and I had taken my pilot son with me, and we were on the way back, and this guy calls from England that's doing the program, and he's interviewing me like you are. But it's on cell phone. We're driving back from Shreveport.
Okay.
And he's asking me about the B-52, and I'm telling him essentially what I'm telling you.
Right.
And he said, so you really didn't like that airplane? And I said, no, I didn't. But I said, there's somebody in this car that thought it was a great airplane, because my son also flew B-52s, and he thought it was a great airplane. I said, here, talk to him. He'll tell you how great the airplane is. So I handed the phone to Mike, and Mike talked to him for about 20 minutes and gave his version of the B-52. So I guess it's just kind of what you like and what you don't like. But I was never. And then the other thing that I hated about that airplane was the landing gear. The gear on the B-52 is what we call a bicycle gear. And the reason we do is because it has two wheels, or it has a forward truck and a rear truck, kind of like the two wheels on a bicycle. The problem with that gear is you cannot really get a smooth landing, because to do it, you'd have to touch both down at the same time, and that's almost impossible.
Right, right.
So what you have to do is get the rear trucks down first, and then the forward truck just slams on the runway. So you never get really smooth landings, whereas in a tricycle gear, a normal airplane, like my B-58, the main gear, you touch them down, and like all airliners, and then you ease the nose down.
Right.
So that was another thing I didn't like about it. But to me, a B-52 was like driving an 18-wheeler. Flying an F-86 or a B-58 was like driving a Maserati. So that's the difference.
But Mike says that the B-52 isn't all that bad.
Mike liked it. He thought it was a good airplane.
Of course, later on he flew the B-1. Is that
right?
Yeah,
and he liked it a lot better.
But it's quite remarkable, the service life of the B-52 design.
And you'll like this story. The History Channel program, the documentary on the B-52.
Right.
And it points out, Laura, what a small planet we live on and how interdependent and how interrelated we are to everyone on this little planet.
Mm-hmm.
I get this phone call one day from this lady. And did I tell you this?
No.
Okay. So she, is this Colonel Yule? Yes. Colonel Yule, we're doing a documentary on the B-52. And I said, where are you talking to me from? She said, well, I'm in London. I said, you're in London. Is your company based in London? Oh, yes, this is where we are. And you're doing a documentary on a B-52? And she said, that's our business. She said, we put together documentaries, and we sell them to A&E and History Channel and those types of, that's our business. And I said, isn't it wonderful? An English company doing a documentary on a B-52 airplane. I said, okay, fine. I said, and she said, well, would you be willing to participate? And I said, certainly, I'd be happy to. And she said, okay. She said, well, I'll get back to you with dates and times, places. I said, well, just send me the tickets. And also, I need some tickets to Wimbledon. And she said, no, we come to you. We'll be in the States, and we'll let you know. So she calls, and anyway, it's fascinating the way they put these things together.
Yeah.
And, but anyway, while we're doing the shoot, and she's interviewing me, and we didn't have this conversation Tuesday.
Well, you told me a little bit about this, right, but we didn't do it on the record.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, the thing that I like to tell people is about it ties in with my feeling about the B-52.
Sure.
Two-thirds of the way through the shoot, she stops the cameraman and says, hold it, John. This program is about the B-52. It's not about the B-58. We don't care about the B-58. And you will say something nice about the B-52. This is about the B-52. Say something good about it. So, okay, I will. And the good things that I said about it, which are absolutely true, I would not be alive today if that airplane was not as sturdy as it was. I took two direct SAM hits. And it's the only reason I'm alive today is because the airplane is so tough, because it could absorb that kind of punishment. It was a lot like the B-17 was in World War II. And the other thing was what you were alluding to about the longevity of the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
If that airplane does fly as long as they project it to into the 40s, that's going to be 90 years that that airplane will be operational.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
Really.
And I told her, I said, did we get our money's worth as taxpayers out of that airplane? And, you know, I had to, at this thing I go to at Randolph every year, this POW thing,
mm-hmm.
our guest speaker a few years ago ran the air war in Kosovo.
Oh, yeah.
And so I went up and talked to him afterwards because Mike flew in Kosovo and he's B-1. And I said, my son wasn't too happy with the air order battle that you signed to the B-1s. And he said, oh, the B-1s. He said, you know, we had to use them. And he said, it's a great weapon system. But he said, we couldn't risk losing B-1s. And he said, that's why we had to give them their targets were right over the border. In fact, Mike, when he was telling me about it, he said, God, he said, we barely got into enemy territory. He said, we dropped our ordnance and we were out of there. He said, we didn't even hardly get into enemy territory. And this three-star, anyway, was telling me, he said, you know what I used primarily in Kosovo was your airplane, the Buff.
Mm-hmm.
He said, that's what we went with. That's what we used. So, yeah, we
now,
got
when they, now, when he was saying that they couldn't lose a B-1 in the Kosovo operations, was that, why was that?
Well,
what
I think
was
it's
he essentially saying?
I think it was the same thing that, and I'm going to shift to another airplane on you here, my B-58, my
uh-huh.
all-time favorite airplane.
Sure.
The Hustler. That airplane never went to Vietnam, but we did have a fly-off against F-4s back in 66, I think, to see if we could, if it could be used in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the results of the bombing were that we were much better than the F-4s were, and we could carry more payload. We had it all over them. But
we meaning the Hustlers.
The Hustlers,
yeah.
That's right.
Right.
But the Air Force probably made the right decision. They said, yes, but we can lose 10 F-4s for one B-58. It's not cost-effective to be using B-58s over there. Plus, the F-4 was still in production. The cost per flying hour wasn't that much. B-58 was out of production. Cost per flying hour was very, very high. So it just didn't make sense to be using the B-58, even though it could perform the mission better.
And that was a cost analysis decision?
Yeah. And that's what put the B-58 in the boneyard was cost analysis. That's why it went in the boneyard.
What were the spikes in the cost pattern that resulted in that decision? Where were the problems in terms of cost for the Air Force?
For the B-58?
Yes.
You mean putting it in the boneyard?
Yeah, why did it... What was it about it that cost
okay,
so much?
In 1969, I guess it would have been. Yeah, 1969. Nixon came out with a big reduction in military spending.
Yes, sir.
And he... And when it came down to SAC got their chop on it and how much was going to be theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And SAC went forward with two proposals. They said, we'll do one or two things. Either we scrap the B-58 fleet entirely, or we cut the B-52 fleet in half. Well, in 69, the Buffs had been bombing in Vietnam already for two or three years.
Mm-hmm.
So they had that mission going, plus the cost per flying hour on a B-52 was much, much less than it was on a B-58.
Why was that? Was it fuel consumption? Or
no,
was it?
No. The two primary reasons.
Uh-huh.
We only had the B-58 was a limited production airplane. They built 114 of them, and
okay.
we only had 80 left.
Okay.
It had been out of production for 3 or 4 years,
uh-huh.
so parts were getting more expensive. And that airplane was a very, very high-maintenance airplane, just due to a lot of things,
okay.
which would take a long time to explain. But when you did maintenance on a B-58, it was much more labor-intensive. It took more time to fix something, to get to the components that you need to replace, whatever. It was just a high-maintenance airplane as compared to a B-52. So they thought, well, you know, and the B-58 had no Vietnam mission. So SAC said, well, or not SAC, Air Force said, well, look, we're using B-52s in Vietnam now. They're much cheaper to operate. So we're just going to scrap the B-58s, and that's what they did.
So they kept. So essentially the Air Force decided, based on what it was presented with by SAC and probably others, to keep the entire B-52 fleet and eliminate the entire B-58 fleet.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and another thing that helped them with that decision,
uh-huh.
the 111 was already coming online, which was a follow-on airplane to the B-58.
So the next generation was already
right.
in view.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
When was the 111 unveiled or made operational?
Oh, gee whiz, that I don't know. I know it had to be in probably in the late 60s somewhere. Because the reason I know it was operational when we put the 58s in the boneyard was because a real good friend of mine who had gone to the 111 program, he was in the initial cadre,
uh-huh.
and he was really leaning on me to go to the 111 program. But I kept asking him, I said, he was telling me about the great avionics package they had in the 111.
Mm-hmm.
I said, yeah, but Bill, which one's more fun to fly? And then he kind of danced around that one. So I said, okay, I think I've got my answer.
Yeah,
I'm going to stay with the Hustler. Well, then I know it was just like 3 months later is when it came out that we were going to scrap the B-58s. And, of course, by then the assignment had passed. I couldn't get in the 111 then.
John, I want to ask you just a couple of essentially timeline questions.
Yeah.
We talked earlier about the Cuban Missile Crisis and
Correct.
Some of your experiences then. Do you remember President Kennedy's assassination that time period?
Oh, yeah.
Where were you? At Altus?
Yes, I was.
Okay.
Yes, I was. In fact, I had just gotten off alert, just walked in the house, and the television set was on in the den. And I don't think we were watching television, but it was on,
uh-huh.
and heard this news flash, you know, that alert, whatever. So that was at Altus at that time.
Did it make any difference to the activities on the base?
I do not recall any change in activity on the base with that.
Okay. I also want to ask another sort of Vietnam-related question. It has to do with early 1965. Again, you were still at Altus. The initial commitment by the United States of forces into the Vietnam conflict, and here I mean ground forces, the Marines,
mm-hmm.
in early 65.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that or the build-up to that? And did it affect your thinking about what likely missions you might have in the future?
No, I don't remember being too intellectually involved or really paying that close attention to
okay.
Vietnam
mm-hmm.
until probably my last year, 66. I think it became more of an issue then, and for a couple of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
One is if the escalation phase was there, and
yes.
also the B-52s were starting to play a role, although we weren't affected at Altus. And the other thing was we had a few of our crew members who had left Altus and volunteered to go to Vietnam in other equipment, not in B-52s, obviously, but in other airplanes. So some of our troops had already gone over there and were in Vietnam in different type aircraft.
So they were volunteering.
Yeah, they were. A lot of people volunteered
mm-hmm.
because, you know, the old story, Laura, in the military, it helps to have a war.
Yeah.
You got to have a war, and none of these guys, and a lot of guys. This is where I was different from a lot of my peers. I love flying airplanes. I particularly love flying high-performance airplanes, but I never had any desire to be shot at. I never saw the glory or fun in being shot at. That never did have appealed to me. But a lot of my friends, they were so excited when we put the 58s in the boneyard, and they knew they were going to be able to go to Vietnam then. Mm-hmm. And they were excited. They thought, oh, this is great. Now I get to the war. I get in the fight. And I guess to a large extent, I can understand why they would, because, you know, you train and train to drop bombs or to do whatever.
Right.
And some guys go through a whole career, and all they do is train. They never get in. It's kind of like an athlete. You go to all the practice sessions, but you never get put in the game. So I can understand why they. But to me, I was perfectly content to just stay right here and fly my airplane, and I had no desire to go to Vietnam.
Well, and certainly as you've told us today, John, there were some pretty hairy and tight moments for you.
Yeah.
Flying the missions you were flying.
Yeah, and nobody was shooting at me.
Yeah, and
so I didn't need to complicate this process.
Okay, well, let's take a break here, John.
Okay.